Blog Talk Radio.
This is Surreal Queen, and you're listening to the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call on Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday Morning Wake Up Call on this 26th of March 2011, as we take you for the next 90 minutes, special edition, as we look at the world of sports here. Surreal Queen. Call number is 347-215-6180. 347-215-6180. I hope you haven't put away all your winter clothes, because around these parts, the East Coast, Northeast, Southeast, well, Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, it is still very much winter, unfortunately. Yeah, it's just, you know, winter just won't go away. So hopefully you're staying bundled up. But we're going to be, and of course, for all my friends listening out there in radio, blog talk radio world, the chat room is open. I will try to, answer some questions or look at some comments on the chat room during the duration of the show. Again, we're going 90 minutes this morning. You can also hit me up on Facebook.com/SurrealQuinn or at Twitter.com/William Gerald. Get my names mixed up here. But we're going to begin with the game of the tournament. Last night, Ohio State, the number one overall seed coming into this tournament, number one team in the country, fell to the Kentucky Wildcats, a young Kentucky team, to say the least, led by three freshmen, 62-60. Great game, basically from start to finish. Ohio State jumped out to like a 7-point lead. At one point, it was like 16-9, or 16-7. But from then on, after that, you know, the game was played basically within a one-possession radius, within one possession. I mean, it ranged around 2 to 4 points. Last 17 minutes, you had, no team had a bigger lead than 3 points. Hotly contested. You know, you give Kentucky all the credit in the world. I was just waiting. You know, you knew that they had the athletes to keep up with Ohio State, that they had the size with Harrelson, who, you know, it's funny about him. Josh Harrelson, who was by far the MVP. I mean, I know Brandon Knight hit the game with his shot, but Harrelson was the MVP of that game. I mean, 17 points, 10 rebounds, 3 block shots. He helped neutralize Sullinger for at least the first half. Sullinger got loose in the second half and had 21 points and 16 rebounds. But it wasn't a impactful 21 points and 16 rebounds. But Harrelson, a week ago, after Kentucky won his second round game, Rick Pitino called him the most underrated college basketball player in the country. And I said to myself, like, what the hell is Pitino talking about? Really? I barely heard of this dude. You know, he might be right, because for what he does with Kentucky, that size inside, you cannot replace. And it proved to be true last night against Ohio State, and it certainly could play a big factor as Kentucky prepares for the Elite Eight game tomorrow, when they take on North Carolina. But he had a big night, really, you know, controlled the middle, offensively and defensively, had a great game, and to me was by far the MVP of that game. And listen, I sat up here, you know, I'm not going to say that I picked Ohio State to win a national championship. I picked them to get to the national championship, picked Kansas to win it. Had to pick somebody to get to the Final Four. But, you know, you look at that game, you look at this tournament overall, and to me, again, we've said this over and over again, there are no dominant teams out there. I mean, there are no dominant teams out there, period. Now, you're going to see everybody jump on the Kansas bandwagon. Oh, Kansas is the clear-cut favorite. It's their championship to lose, so on and so on. Okay. I mean, you can make that mistake if you want to. But if you didn't learn anything last night, then I guess you'll never learn in watching that game, watching a Kentucky team that is a year away. I mean, this Kentucky team, this is the, you know, the funny thing about the Kentucky-North Carolina matchup tomorrow, when you have the two most storied programs as far as winning percentages, as far as winning winning games goes, headed against each other tomorrow as far as all-time wins. Kentucky's one, North Carolina's two. Both those teams were perceived to be at least a year away as far as being a Final Four national championship type team. Kentucky just lost five first-round draft picks, and they find themselves back in the Elite Eight for the second straight year. See, I give Calipari a lot of credit for having this team get back to this point. I didn't think, I saw Kentucky over the course of a year. I didn't think that they were anything special. I knew Terrence Jones was a very good player. Brandon Knight, I thought the freshmen were talented. Thought they had a lot of athleticism. I mean, we all knew this. But, Final Four, possibly championship caliber, that's something that I certainly did not see coming out of this Kentucky team. And they played Ohio State. They went toe-to-toe with Ohio State. That was not a fluke. That was not one of those, just magical upsets, Bucknell, Kansas, or, almost Princeton, Georgetown, 20 years ago. Princeton almost won. That Villanova, Georgetown, I should say. Kentucky deserved to win that game. They outplayed Ohio State. They controlled Ohio State from the 3-point line, neutralized that. Again, kept Sullinger in check. Didn't allow him to go crazy. Again, his 21 points, 16 rebounds. You look at his numbers, you say, hey, he put up some big time numbers. Yes, they're impressive, but they did not impact the game to where he was dominating that game. But give the kid, again, Brandon Knight, all the credit in the world. He's made big shot after big shot in this tournament. You saw what he did against Princeton. It doesn't matter, how bad or how poorly he's shooting. He has no fear, similar to another freshman that he's going to be facing tomorrow afternoon in Harrison Barnes of North Carolina. No fear in taking the big shot. Absolutely zero fear. And again, Ohio State, listen, I think the problem with Ohio State was, and it's a problem with a lot of these teams who are 3-point happy, is live by the three, die by the three. If they're not making a good percentage of 3-point shots, they're going to have a tough time, especially in these NCAA tournament games. Sure, I mean, you can shoot a lot of threes and blow somebody out the building like they did George Mason, but when you're not making them, you're left with struggling to find offense. And, Ohio State goes out there and scores, 60 points. And, you see Buford go basically 2-for-16, including missing the last shot that would have won the game. And then why is a dangerous proposition to be dependent on the 3-point shot. I like how Calipari handled the in-game situation by not calling a timeout. A lot of times, especially with a young team, it would just be, automatic timeout, set up a play. When you do that, and, sometimes it is appropriate, sometimes it's not. To me, when you do that, you are really allowing another team to set up their defense, and I think it's harder to score against rather than, hey, they made a big, Ohio State makes a 3-point shot to tie the game, get the ball, and go right at them. And it wasn't bad defense by Ohio State. The kid just made a great shot with a hand in his face. Give him credit. But, again, I had to give Calipari a lot of credit for just allowing his players to make plays, not trying to, micromanage the game by calling a timeout. Had a little problem with how Ohio State handled the last possession. I did not like going for the 3-point shot when you're down by two. If you're VCU playing Kentucky, then I have no problem with it. But you're Ohio State is a better team than Kentucky. So I think that to me, you put the onus on the officials to go out there, make a call. Maybe Sullinger, maybe you get a drive for a penetration to where Sullinger can get an offensive rebound, something of that nature. To me, going for a 3-point shot in that situation, you're bailing out the defense. you're really bailing Kentucky out, not really forcing them to play, you know, to play a quality defense. All you have to do is just get a hand up in a man's face, and you know what, if he makes a three, then so be it, you know, we'll shake his hand and go home. So I did not like how I wasn't crazy about the last shot that Ohio State got. That was standing, again, Kentucky advances to the Elite Eight where they will face North Carolina. Kentucky is number 4 seed, North Carolina is number 2 seed, and North Carolina, which just toyed with Marquette last night, 81-60. Carolina goes out there, and they're fronting this. And this, I thought North Carolina would win this game, not this easily, not this easy, of course, but, you know, too much size for North Carolina. I mean, North Carolina, I've said it before, has an NBA-caliber front line. You're talking Harrison Barnes, 6'8", Henson, 6'10", and Zeller, who's playing great right now at 7 foot. Just too much size for Marquette. They, all three of those players dominated the game. They didn't need anything from the guards. I mean, Kendall Marshall, you know, basically just, you know, ran the show, didn't turn over the ball. And Carolina, despite a sloppy last, say, 10 minutes of the game, you know, built up such a big build-up. At one point, it had a 30-point lead and just was on cruise control for the rest of the game as they advanced. Kansas took out Richmond. Again, another game that was ho-hum. The first two games were just, you as a fan, you were owed Ohio State, Kentucky, and then the overtime game with Florida State and VCU, because the first two games were over by, like, halftime. I mean, you know, Marquette comes out there 10-8 on North Carolina. Next thing you know, North Carolina, you know, goes on like a 32-5 run, and you know, it's what, 42-13, and it's 40-15 at halftime. The game was over, and then Kansas Richmond. You never got a sense that Richmond was ever going to was going to be in that game. Richmond did a great job by just getting that far. So Kansas, North Carolina took care of their business. Kansas, how about if you're Kansas? They have not had one tough game yet. The highest seed that they've played against was, I believe, it was Illinois at number 9. They're going to go through basically a 16, a 9, a 11, and coming up tomorrow, they'll have, of course, they will have VCU, who was a number 11 seed. Richmond was a number 12. So three of their seeds that they've gone through so far will be double digit seeds. So an easy path, to say the least. An easy path to say, at least, to get to the Final Four. Does that mean that they are going to, you know, win it? You know, we'll see. But they should have no trouble tomorrow with VCU. I mean, again, I know VCU has played well. They were fortunate last night to beat Florida State. Florida State did not handle the in-game situation well last night in overtime. Didn't get off a good shot. Allowed VCU to get allowed them to score too easily with the inbounds pass, for the layup. But Kansas should be able to handle VCU tomorrow and get to the Final Four. We'll talk more about the Elite Eight matchups as the program goes along. Again, Florida State did not handle that situation well. Again, I did not like how. You know, you got to get off a better shot at the end of overtime than what they got off. But give VCU credit with standing. VCU advances to the Elite Eight to face Kansas. So you will have today, you'll have Butler and Florida in the Southeast. You have Butler, Florida in the Southeast, and you will have Arizona and Connecticut in the West. So those will be the two. Those will be the two 4 teams who are trying to get to the Final Four today. Later on today on CBS, of course. So 8 teams remain in the tournament. I stopped looking at my bracket like a week ago. So I remember picking Kansas to win it over Ohio State. I did have UConn, Kansas, Ohio State, and St. John's in the Final Four. So I still have three of my first Final Four teams alive. But, you know, when you have one bracket that you totally just get destroyed, you I stopped paying attention to it a while ago in regards to the teams that in regards to my bracket. So yeah, we're down to 8 teams now, and again, everybody is going to be on the Jayhawks bandwagon. Everybody. I'll say this right now, right here, right now. Kansas will not win the national championship. I'll just come out and say it, not even save you, just save the tease, save all the teases, save my picks or whatever, and I will pick the Elite Eight before the program is over. But Kansas will not win the national championship. This is the Saturday morning wake-up call on this 26th of March, 2011, 15 minutes after the 11 o'clock hour. We're taking you to the bottom. We're taking you to 12:30 this afternoon. 90-minute edition, 347-215-6180 is your call number, 347-215-6180 is your call number. Coming up, we have Saturday morning headlines and Barry Bonds versus the United States. We'll talk about that and much, much more on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call.
Welcome back. Your dreams were your ticket out. Welcome back to that same old place that you laughed about. Well, the names have all changed since you hung around, but those dreams have remained and they've turned around. Who'd have thought they'd lead ya?
Who'd have thought they'd lead ya?
Back here where we need ya.
Back here where we need ya.
Yeah, we tease him a lot, cause we got him on the spot. Welcome back.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back.
Saturday morning wake up call, 17 minutes after the 11 o'clock hour. I'm your host, Real Quinn. As we look at today's Saturday morning headlines, Jim Tressel, Ohio State football head coach, emailed a mentor of quarterback Terrell Pryor, the information, Ted Sarniak, the information that Pryor and other Ohio State players were in trouble in regards to the memorabilia that they were selling. And this, again, the emails that were sent to Sarniak was information that was given to him before it ever reached, of course, the NCAA or even Ohio State University. And this is now Ted Sarniak, who is he's an Ohio businessman. Excuse me, a Pennsylvania businessman who had a relationship with Terrell Pryor. The details of that relationship, nobody knows right now. I mean, it sounds a little dicey when you know, is he a friend of the family? All you know is the guy is a well-to-do businessman in the state of Pennsylvania. That's all we know about this guy, basically. But apparently, he knows Pryor very well. Tressel forwarded him the emails that he was given to Sarniak, hoping that Sarniak would help Pryor out, whatever sense you want to make out of that. Again, this is the mystery guy who the emails were forwarded, who Tressel contacted during the press conference. A few weeks ago, Ohio State Athletic Director Gene Smith, you know, really stopped Tressel from going further into this investigation. I mean, into this story. And listen, if you want to know why Tressel added 3 games or wanted 3 games added to his suspension. This is the reason. Because eventually this was going to come out as it did. And, you know, now if you're the NCAA, to me, it's, listen, if he's not, if Trussell isn't suspended for the season, then the NCAA is the biggest phony, or the biggest phonies of all time. Again, he, I mean, Trussell sends there, he gives you information, gives information to this guy who, for all we know, could be, you know, funding Terrell Pryor. Could be, there's no, I mean, again, the relationship between Terrell Pryor and this guy is, you know, is a mystery. And I'm sure that the NCAA will come out and say, well, we're looking further into this, we're looking further into their relationship and so on and so on. But if the NCAA doesn't suspend Trussell for the season, or just all Big Ten games, then, you know, you can't take them seriously. And again, the question is, what is the relationship between this guy and Jim Trussell? Excuse me, and Terrell Pryor? You know, in the article that by the Columbus Dispatch, you have describes it as a mentor, you know, type relationship where Pryor reaches out for advice from this dude. And I mean, it sounds like it's more to it that again, that has not come out yet. But again, this is more baggage for Ohio State. More baggage for Jim Trussell. And again, this eventually was going to come out. And, you know, there was a reason. It had nothing to do with his conscience. But again, there was a reason why Trussell wanted to up his suspension from 2 games to 5 games. And I don't think it's a coincidence that basically a week or 2 weeks later that this story comes out about this Tez Sarniak. Green Bay defensive lineman Johnny Jolly faces a drug charge. Jolly, the Green Bay Packers defensive lineman who didn't play all of this year because he was suspended for violating the league's substance abuse policy, got caught with 600 grams of codeine in his car. Also, so he's going to get charged with possession of a controlled substance with an intent to distribute. His days in Green Bay, with the way Green Bay drafts and the way they replace players, you have to think that his days as a Green Bay Packer are over. He's a pretty good player when he's on the field. But he's had some issues, again, in the past couple of seasons with this. Again, I'd be shocked if he were a Green Bay Packer come next season. 347-215-6180 is your call number. 347-215-6180 is your call number. When we return, we will get into the Barry Bonds case, which was in week one. We're in a week two of his trial. So we'll get into that, and we'll also have some React quotes as well on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. 5 minutes after the 11 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. Cyril Quinn taking you to, of course, 12:30 this afternoon. 90-minute edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. Elite Eight weekend. Of course, the NCAA tournament is down to its final eight teams. You'll have action today in the West and Southeast brackets. And, of course, it will conclude tomorrow, the Elite Eight, with the East and Southwest brackets. Also, a note that I failed to mention about Ohio State. You know, it's not all bad for them. They will. Jared Sullinger, without question, the freshman of the year, will come back next year for his sophomore season. He needs to come back. I mean, you like his game, 6'9", can do some things, but he needs to develop a 15 to 20 footer if he wants to play at a high level in the NBA. I mean, he can come out right now and be a top 5 pick, but he will be sitting on the bench for a couple of years because his game is still not fully developed. Has a chance to be probably maybe a number one pick next year. Who knows? And he'll certainly come out next year and be a top 5 pick. But you know, it's not all bad if you're a Ohio State Buckeye. And I know. Listen, you know, when you think it's your year, every sports fan has gone through this. When you think it's your year, and your team hasn't won it for a long time, Ohio State hasn't won a championship in basketball. I mean, you got to go back to, I would think, the Jerry Lucas days in the 60s when Bob Knight was on the team. Bob Knight obviously wasn't a major player. He was just, a role player at best. If that, I think Bob Knight didn't even play a lot. But he was on those teams that won back-to-back national championships in the 60s. It's hard. It's a tough loss to take because, I can remember a few years back, the UConn fan, Connecticut. This is before Calhoun won a championship in 99. They had a year when they had Ray Allen and Daron Sheffer and Donnie Marshall and Kevin Ollie. They had a team that was loaded in 1996, coming off an Elite Eight loss to UCLA. Came in 1996, ranked number one, and everybody saying, yeah, UConn, along with Kentucky in 96. I have to be fair about that. But everybody saying, yeah, UConn's going to get to the Final Four, they're going to get to the championship and have this battle with Kentucky, and it never came about because Mississippi State took them out in the Sweet 16. So, Ohio State fans, and there was no Kentucky, and even then, UConn could have lost to Kentucky easily in that particular year. But for Ohio State, this year was no dominant team. Being number one for the majority of the year, it just was not meant to be. So, Dabon is a great recruiter. He'll get some guys in there to around Sullinger to make another run at the championship come next year. As far as Barry Bonds goes, of course, you have week one of his trial. The thing that stood out to me was the testimony of Steve Hoskins, his former friend and former business manager, a business partner. He handled memorabilia for Bonds and, with jerseys and gloves and things of that nature. Claims that he saw Barry Bonds and Greg Anderson walk into a room and where he guessed that Greg Anderson injected Barry Bonds with a steroid, never saw it, but saw them walk into a room and, just assumes that was the case. Hoskins, his testimony is questionable because you're trying to think, what do you want to paint him as? Do you really want to paint him as the disgruntled ex, partner who had a falling out with Bonds and now wants his revenge? Or do you paint him as the sentimental friend who claims that he was looking out for Bonds' best interests by trying to, get him off the steroids? He taped the conversation with Greg Anderson and claimed that he was going to give it to Barry Bonds' late father, Bobby Bonds. This is, of course, going back to like around 2000, had to be 2002, 2003. Bobby Bonds passed away in the summer of 2003, which doesn't make much sense because, if you're really trying to help out Barry Bonds by telling Bobby Bonds, why didn't you just go directly to Bobby Bonds? Why didn't you go directly to Bobby Bonds and tell him, hey, I think steroid usage is getting out of control. You might want to look into it. Why tape a conversation with Greg Anderson and just say, hey, what, you're going to get to Bobby Bonds and say, hey, listen to this. That part of it, I did not understand. And, you know, the defense had a field day with this, basically tried to discredit him, as he's trying to make himself out to be the sentimental, caring friend. I would have to lean towards a disgruntled ex-business partner more than I would the friend that is trying to help Barry Bonds out. So to me, that was the big testimony that came out of this week in regards to Bonds, in regards to this whole Barry Bonds case. Next week, you'll have Kimberly Bell, his mistress or ex-mistress. Stan Conti, who used to run Balco, Kathy Hoskins, Steve Hoskins' wife. You had them testify the trial did not run on Fridays. It'll be Monday through Thursday will be the days. And again, with this case, you wonder, is it worth it for the government to go through all of this to try to get Barry Bonds to come at Barry Bonds? If he's charged on all five accounts, found guilty on all five accounts, the most time he can do is 18 to 30 months, and that's with all accounts. He's not, which is highly unlikely that he'd be charged on all accounts. And, you know, if you're the government, if he is charged on all accounts, what have you accomplished if you're the government? You have wasted billions of dollars of taxpayers' money to go after this guy. I mean, you're not discrediting him. He's already done that to himself. You know, in the baseball world, Barry Bonds is not looked upon. He's not even looked upon as a real home run king. Hank Aaron is. He may never get into the Hall of Fame, even though I think he deserves to be there. You know, we won't get a good sense of that until 2013, when he'll become eligible. So, you know, again, in the grand scheme of things, what would the government accomplish by coming after him? And by getting him possibly going to jail, and I'll tell you right now, I don't think Barry Bonds does a day of jail in his life. Now the government, they claim, people covering this case closely claim that they can prove. They can't get a conviction without Greg Anderson's testimony and try to prove that Bonds lied about taking steroids. Good luck. Good luck with that. That he knowingly took the steroids. But to me, it's not worth the government's time or the energy to come after this guy the way they're coming after him. Because he's almost, and again, if Bonds was a little bit more likable, if he was a little bit unthinkable, a little bit more likable, he would almost be a martyr in the eyes of the public, or even a victim. But nobody likes Bonds, so they say, hey, you know, we're not going to go too crazy about the way that the Nowitzki and the other prosecution is coming at him. Still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, we will have React Quotes and we will preview our we will do our final preview as opening day in the baseball season is upon us on Thursday, March 31st, coming up on this on March 31st. We'll do our final preview of the NL East Division, our final baseball preview, the NL East Division. So we'll talk about that and much, much more on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. After the 11 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, this host Cyril Quinn, 347-215-6180 is your call number. 347-215-6180 is your call number as we head into this Elite Eight weekend of NCAA tournament action. React quotes. Here we go. I don't care if your feet kill you. That is one, Michael Jeffrey Jordan, who apparently had a problem with Harrison Barnes wearing Kobe Bryant's latest sneaker that came out. Jordan didn't like it. You know, of course, Jordan is the outfit for North Carolina basketball as far as the apparel, warm-up sneakers, the whole nine yards, and it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek with Harrison Barnes, but you get a sense that with Kobe Bryant approaching his sixth championship possibly that Jordan's getting a little, nervous by the fact that Kobe Bryant could possibly tie him for championships. Jordan, is it really a big deal that, that Harrison Barnes or any other North Carolina player where Kobe Bryant said Michael Jordan's? And doesn't Michael Jordan own the Charlotte Hornets? I'm sure there are more important aspects of Michael Jordan's life that he can focus on other than what Harrison Barnes has on his feet. Unless it's some Converse and some Adidas. So I don't think this was about the shoe as much as it is about the fact that Kobe Bryant more than likely will tie him for not most championships, because Russell and, there are guys who have won more championships, but for, four championships in a career with still time left in at 32 years old, still a good amount of years left in his career, and more opportunities to even pass Jordan. Jordan's a competitor. We all know he's a competitor, and we all know he's taken, subtle shots at Bryant in the past, saying that he was definitely one of the top 10 guards ever and, things of that nature. And Jordan's not the only one out of the old guard to take shots at Bryant, in the past, in this past year. I mean, even Magic Johnson, you know, after the finals. Well, now he deserves a statue. Really, Magic, he now deserves a statue that he's tied you in terms of championships with five. So, and of course, Magic was all up in arms. Didn't publicly say this, but, you know, deep down inside, Magic Johnson was all up in arms that, you know, Kobe Bryant is considered to be the greatest Laker of all time, which he is. So, you know, I think Jordan's starting to feel the heat a little bit, and, you know, we'll see. You know, I want to see Jordan's reaction if and when Kobe Bryant and the Lakers do win a championship this year, which they certainly will enter the playoffs as the favorites to do so. Just want to see Jordan's reaction to that. I want to hear what he has to say at that point. I told the guy I'm not trying to get in trouble. That is one Dallas Cowboy wide receiver now going to his second year, Dez Bryant, who, along with three other guys, was kicked out of a Dallas mall for apparently wearing their pants, you know, hanging off their asses. And, you know, a cop stopped him. Hey, pull up your pants. There's an argument. And then officers kicked him out of the mall. Dez Bryant claims that he, you know, his pants wasn't his pants, were not sad. He wasn't sagging his pants. It was his boys. Well, if that was the case, then why are you cursing at the officers, saying, I'm Dez Bryant, and blah, and so on and so on. If you personally were not in the wrong, wouldn't you just say, hey, when you tell the friends that are with you, pull them up so we can, you know, go about our business and keep it moving. I mean, that would be the sensible thing to do. That would make the most sense to me. If my pants are up, and I got boys that are with me who, for whatever reason, whose pants are sagging, officer coming to you, hey, man, put up your pants. But, of course, we know that wasn't the case. We know Dez Bryant, along with the three other guys, had his pants sagging. Officer told him to pull him up. He said, I'm Dez Bryant. I played for the Dallas Cowboys. I was the number one draft pick. Officer's basically like, well, you know, sir, we don't care. Pull your pants up. And then that's when the whole, you know, cursing and tirade and this and that, that's the back and forth, you know, occurs. And this is a sad story because this is the type of story that should be happening. This is the type of story that I should be reading about on my way to work when I pick up a Metro paper every morning. 12, 13-year-olds get kicked out of Pentagon City for sagging their pants. Not Dez Bryant, 21, 22-year-old Dez Bryant, professional athlete, gets kicked out of the mall for wearing his pants low. I mean, dude, you play in the NFL. You are a professional athlete, and you're in a mall with your pants hanging off your ass? I mean, are you kidding me? You got to be kidding me. This is not even high school. This is middle school type stuff. I deal with kids every day. I tell you, so my kids, hey, yeah, pull your pants up a little bit. Yeah, pull your pants up. Take off your hat. These are 12 and 13. These are 10, 8, 9, 10, 12, 13-year-olds. Dez Bryant is a grown man. You are a professional athlete. Put the emphasis on professional. I'd like to see how smart D.O. Epstein is with the Tampa Bay payroll. You got Carl Crawford because you paid more than anyone else, and that's what makes you smarter. That's why I like whipping their butt. That's the second year Baltimore Orioles manager Buck Showalter laying down the gauntlet before the upcoming 2011 baseball season. Basically, you know, taking a shot at Boston Red Sox, New York Yankees, all these other big payroll teams that buy all these free agents and saying, hey, you don't have to be a genius to go out there and pay the most money for the best players. And to a certain extent, he's right. You know, it doesn't take a genius to go out there and sign A-Rod or sign, you know, a Mark Teixeira and what have you. I give Buck a lot of credit because you know, what he's trying to do, similar to Rex Ryan in New York, is he's trying to, listen, he's trying to establish an identity for his baseball team, saying that we don't care who you are, we're not going to take any stuff, we're going to challenge, we're coming to play every game, day in, day out. We're not afraid of you. We don't care if you're the Yankees. We don't care about if you're the Red Sox. We don't care about who you are. We're coming to beat you. We're not kissing your ass. We're coming to beat you. And I like that mentality. Al Showalter letting his team know. We respect you in terms of what you can do on the field and the championship you have won, but we're still coming to beat you. And, you know, the Orioles have now, the Orioles can play Pittsburgh every game, and they might go undefeated, as they are 5-0 against them in spring training, but that's not going to be the case. I said on my preview for the AL East a few weeks back that the Orioles are going to be improved. Showalter alone adds 5 or 6 more games because he's going to have them disciplined. He's going to have them. They're going to do the small fundamental things that it takes to win games. And he's already got an improved lineup. We'll see what happens with the pitching. So the Orioles are going to be better. But I like that quote out, Buck Showalter. I don't hate the Red Sox, to be honest with you. I hate the Yankees. Red Sox, I can understand why somebody would hate the Red Sox because they are like the Yankees. They are the Yankees of the New England area. I mean, they are the closest thing to being the Yankees as the Yankees, if that makes sense. So their payroll is going to be ridiculous, just like the Yankees is, and they are, one of those teams that are going to be considered as one of the teams to beat in all of baseball. Still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call, we will stay with the baseball and talk about the NL East. Can the Philadelphia Phillies, how many games will the Phillies win and with one of the most dominant pitching staffs in recent memory? We'll talk about that, and we'll also talk about a surprise team in that division. That's coming up on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call. We'll be right back. Good morning, Wake Up Call. I'm your host, Surreal Quinn. Welcome back to the program. Having a little fun here with somebody in the chat line, Jay Drew, who seems to be a fellow Tar Heels fan, saying go Heels, and I concur, go Tar Heels. And where's Duke, by the way? Has anybody seen the Duke Blue Devils? Has anybody seen the Duke? What happened to Duke? I'm trying. Oh, that's right. They got their ass kicked by Arizona and Derek Williams. That's what happened to Duke. Right. That's right. I just wanted to just send a friendly reminder to all my Duke fans out there who just, you know, thought that they were going to win a championship. Kyrie Irving's back. We're back. No, wasn't going to happen. Was not going to happen at all. They and I didn't talk about those Thursday games. I will touch on them before the program is out, because I think on Thursday night you saw the number one. If you had any question on who was going to be the number one pick in the draft, those questions should be erased if that guy chooses to come out. In terms of Derek Williams, that dude is, he is hands and shoulders by far and away the best player in college basketball. So we'll talk more about that before the program is over with. NL East time. We're looking at the NL East, our final division, as we head into the baseball season. I can't wait until the baseball season starts on Thursday with opening day. An abbreviated opening day, to say at least. I believe that only 6 games, which I don't understand that. I guess I have to just enjoy those 6 games. I'm going to try to make the Nationals game on Thursday. They play the Braves. I'm going to try to get out there to the stadium and see what's good with the Nats. I'm looking forward to them this year. It's a big year for the Nationals. They need to improve, and you know, Jason Worth. They need to improve from what they've been the last couple of years. I think they're headed in the right direction, but now it's all about showing it on the field. As far as the National League East goes, you're going to start, of course, at the top, and it's the worst kept secret in baseball who the best team in the NL East is, and that's, of course, the Philadelphia Phillies. They are, without question, not only the team to beat in the NL East, but maybe the team to beat in all of baseball. The best starting pitching staff in baseball, I don't think there's any question about it, despite what the Red Sox have in Boston or what the Giants have in San Francisco. When you can put a pitching staff out there with Holiday, Hamels, Oswalt, Cliff Lee, and Joe Blanton is your fifth starter, then that pitching staff is, you know, again, bar none, the best starting pitching staff in all of baseball. The question to me is, how many games will the Phillies win? They should win anywhere. I would say from 100 to 110. I mean, they should win over 100 games with that lineup. I mean, with that pitching staff, the lineup is still very good. And now, it is not what it once was, okay? This is not the lineup that won a championship back in 08. It's not even as good. It's not even the lineup that, you know, went to the World Series in 2009. So question marks about, you know, Chase Utley. He will start the season off on a DL. Can Jimmy Rollins bounce back? Had an off year. The age of Raul Ibanez, you know, Ryan Howard came off a bad year, but you expect him to get back in the 40 home run, 130, you know, RBI categories, you know, 130 RBI range. So the lineup has some question marks. Dominic Brown, how good is him? Trying to replace Jason Worth. Jason Worth, for the last 3 years, was one of the most productive offensive outfielders in the game. So you can say that the Nationals overpaid to get him, and I think they did. But you can't take away from his productivity over the course of his tenure with the Philadelphia Phillies. Bullpen is a question to me in terms of Lidge. I like their middle relief, and with Madsen, Contreras, Romero, they're very good. But Lidge is always a question mark. Number one, he's, you know, with his health. And number two, even when he is healthy, you just don't know which Brad Lidge you're going to get. He can look dominant at times. He can also look like he doesn't even belong in the major leagues at times. So, you know, we'll see. You know, we'll see what happens with that. Again, you have a major story on your hands if the Philadelphia Phillies are not world champions. Excuse me. Let me calm down here. And the Philadelphia Phillies are not NL East champions. So I definitely think the Phillies ought to seem to be in that division and will win that division. Will win that division by at least 5 games. Next in line, I would say, would be the Atlanta Braves. I like the Braves pitching staff a lot. Braves coming off a year where they won 91 games, made it to the NL, made it to the wild card, and lost, of course, lost to the Giants. Lost to the eventual Giants, who of course won the championship. Braves added some nice pieces. I mean, Scott Lindenbrick to the bullpen, Dan Uggla to their offense. Starting pitching is very good with Derek Lowe and Jair Jurgens and Tommy Hansen, Tim Hudson, who had a big time year last year. The fifth starter is a question mark. Who knows who that will be? But you know, the bullpen is very good with Kimbrel closing, Venters, Mullen. I mean, the Braves have a lot of talent. They have a lot of young talent with this new kid Freeman. And you know, Hayward, you expect Hayward to have a great second year. Again, it's second year, they get a healthy Martín Prado back. That hurt them going down the stretch with Prado being out for the playoffs and being out down the stretch. Again, we already talked about Dan Uggla, Brian McCann, one of the best offensive catchers in baseball. So the Braves should be fine. No Bobby Cox this year. We'll see how that goes and how that affects the dynamic of the team. But that team, on paper, they are the second best team in that division. The wild card team in this division, to me, is the Florida Marlins. The Marlins, to me, can go in either direction. They could challenge the Phillies and the Braves, possibly if everything goes right, or they could just fall off the cliff and just have a bad year. There's no question to me their talent. When you look at what they bring to the table, with Hanley Ramirez is one of the best players in all of baseball. They have pretty good starting. You have a good young player in Gabby Sanchez. Mike Stanton had a good year last year. Their starting pitching outside of Josh Johnson is a bit of a question mark. Nolasco, can he step up and do the job of Ricky Nolasco? You know, I like what they did. I like the addition of Javier Vasquez as a legit number three, or maybe even number four starter. Annabelle Sanchez, Chris Falstead. They have talent as far as their pitching goes. Those guys just have a hard time staying healthy, number one. And number two, they're just outside Josh Johnson. They're not consistent. Now, depending on which Javi Vasquez they get, could go a long way in determining what this team does. Javi Vasquez has been good 1 year since 07. He's been on and off. He had a good 07, bad 08, good 09. And 2010, he was just basically average. He was 10-10. So if you get good Javier Vasquez, then this team could be dangerous. Their bullpen is pretty good with Hensley. It's decent with Nunez is closing. I like Hensley. Beyond that, it could be a little bit suspect. So they're not deep with their bullpen. I mean, they're not deep in terms of their bullpen. They may want to look to add into their bullpen around the trading deadline. Again, their lineup, we talked about John Buck was a good addition. Did they overpay to get him? Yes, but he did have a big year last year in Toronto. Hanley Ramirez, if he can just keep his head on straight, is one of the five best players in all of baseball. And again, this is a team that, you know, can go in either direction. I think they finished third behind the Mets. Behind the Phillies and the Braves. Team on the rise, I would have to say the Washington Nationals. I think the Nationals will be improved. I like the addition of Jason Worth, of course, picking up, and I like the additions overall. I mean, Adam LaRoche, Rick Angel, Jason Worth will help the offense. Zimmerman is a star. You need Nigel Morgan and Ian Desmond to improve, and you need something. The most important player on the Nationals, a guy who needs to step up in the worst way, is John Lannon. John Lannon, I've been hearing for the last, since the Nationals became, since the Nationals got, since Washington got baseball back in 2005, I've been hearing how, you know, John Landon is going to be the next possible big-time pitcher, all this potential he has. John Landon has not had 1 year in his career where he's finished over 500. It is about time for him to step up and establish himself. And I'm not even asking him. I'm not asking him to be Roy Halladay. I'm not asking him to be, John Lester. I'm not asking him to be a legit number one. I don't think he is a number one. I'm asking him to be a number three or a number two. I'm asking him to be a 15-10 guy. See, I'm asking him for 15-10, 3.8 ERA or 4 ERA and eat up a lot of innings. That's all I'm asking out of John Landon. You would think that Jason Marquis will bounce back. Jordan Zimmerman, who knows? We know he has talent, but, you know, still one of these young pitchers who is trying to find himself in the major leagues. Their bullpen is very good. You know, Burnett will help out. Clipper had a very good year last year. You know the potential of Drew Storen as the closer. Henry Rodriguez also is another good arm to be having there. So they have, you see the direction of where they're going. You like the direction of where the Nationals are going. You just question whether they can put it all together. And go out there and improve and be the type of team that not so much challenges for a division. I don't think we expect that, but be the type of team that could be a pain in the neck for a contender in September. You know, can the Nationals be a spoiler to the Phillies, or I shouldn't say, or to a team that's trying to make the wild card, trying to make the playoffs? That's all you're asking out of the Nationals. You know, I think reasonably 75 wins would be a good season. A good 75 to 80 wins. If they finish 500, that'd be a great season. It'd be a tremendous season. So you're just looking for improvement. I think they will be improved, and we'll see what happens over the course of the year. Wait till next year. That will be the theme of the New York Mets. The Mets just are awful. I mean, the Mets, all the stuff that's going on off the field certainly does not help. But even their on-the-field product, they have a bunch of age. Here are the Mets' key additions. Chris Capone, Ronnie Paulino, and Chris Young, and DJ Carrasco. Three or four years ago, Chris Young was one of, was a good up-and-coming young pitcher for the San Diego Padres. But he has not been able to stay on the field. You know, since 2007, he hasn't made more than, he can't stay on the field as far as his injuries go. You don't know when Johan Santana is coming back. They want to speculate late June, early July. Who knows? Pitching staff is not awful as far as, Pelfrey, R.A. Dickey, Nice. But beyond that, you're going to have to hope that R.A. Dickey has a type of year that he had last year. You don't know what you're going to get out of Capone, Chris Young. Nice is okay. Pelfrey is your horse. So you're going to have a big year out of him. The bullpen outside of Francisco Rodriguez and Bobby Parnell is horrible. And the lineup, again, can Jose Reyes stay healthy? Can Ike Davis, have a similar year to what he had last year? You have to certainly get more than 24 home runs out of your starting outfield in terms of Beltran, Jason Bay, and Angel Pagan. And Angel Pagan had a very good year last year, but Carlos Beltran and Jason Bay, who knows about those guys? I mean, Jason Bay had 6 home runs last year. 6. Beltran, again, has had some injury issues over the past couple of last year. He certainly would be a guy that they would look to move if things don't go, if they don't have this amazing season and they're struggling towards the All-Star break. So, to me, the Mets need to really just tear it apart and just move and start over. That's what the Mets should do. Again, I think the Nationals will finish ahead of the Mets. I think the Mets are the worst team, or the worst to consider what's going on off the field with the Madoff and, with the Wilpons. I think the Mets are in for another long season. I think they will finish in last place. So there you go with your NL East baseball preview. Again, we could do something on Thursday with just looking at opening day. you know, stay tuned for that possibly. But, again, I think the Phillies are the team to beat in this division. Still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call, we'll do a little NBA. We'll do a little NBA, and I will tell you the real reason why the NFL moved up the kickoffs to the 35-yard line. I'll do that, and also we'll wrap up. We'll look back at the elite, look ahead to the Elite Eight and so forth. 347-215-6180 is your call number. 347-215-6180 is your call number. This is the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call.
Led a team who had a ton of injuries,
with Boozer and Joakim Noah to the best record in the Eastern Conference, second best record in the NBA. So so to me, there's no question that he is the MVP right now. This week, of course, you had a classic down in Los Angeles at the Staples Center. A quick, funny story about that. I believe it was on a Tuesday night. Yeah, it was Tuesday. It was Tuesday night. I come home. I am tired as all can be. On Tuesday. I'm saying to myself, God, I'm going to get to bed before 11 o'clock, before 11:30. So I watched more of the Lakers-Phoenix game than I wanted to. And watched up to halftime. Lakers, it seemed like the Lakers were about to take control of the game. They were up by 6 at halftime. I'm like, you know, this game, it is what it is. I'm tired. I'm going to bed. It's over with. Wake up the next morning, get my phone, and receive a text at 1:45 a.m. from my cousin who, you know, texted me, you know, I didn't know that Ron Artest could still do that. Like, you know, what the hell are you talking? What are you talking about? He sent me a text at 1:45 saying about Ron Artest. So I didn't think much of it until I saw that the game with the triple overtime and then Ron Artest had this dunk, which, you know, he doesn't dunk that often. I'm like, that makes sense. So I missed the triple overtime. And I missed the game of the year, basically. Wild game. Kobe almost had a triple-double. Shannon Fry was out there hitting jumpers like Larry Bird. And three Lakers had 20 points. One, it was 139 to 137. So I missed the game of the year. I missed the game of the year as a Laker fan. You know, no big deal. It's not the playoffs yet. As far as on the other side of the spectrum, the New York Knicks are just can't do anything right now. They are 7-11. They are 7-11 with Carmelo Anthony since the trade. You see Carmelo Anthony standing away from the huddle, which you saw last night. This is the second time that he's done this in the last couple of weeks, where, you know, his other four teammates have been a part of the huddle, have been in the huddle. He's just, you know, he's standing away by himself. Last night might not have been the huddle, but he was standing away from this. He was separated from the other four guys. You know, last week he refuses to talk after a 6-point game. You know, this is New York. And, you know, you wanted to come to New York. You took the money. You wanted the bright lights, all the attention. Well, here it is. So, you know, you can't sit up here and stand away from, you know, separate yourself from your teammates. Yeah, you know, you're struggling right now. Team is struggling right now. But this is the part, you know, the grass is not always greener on the other side. And you look at what Denver is doing right now. It is evident. It is evident that, you know, that Denver, you know, as of right now, Denver has the edge in terms of that trade. Now, long term, we'll see what happens. But Denver has played great. The Knicks have struggled. I mean, the record speaks for itself. I still think the Knicks in a matchup, if they were to match up against the Miami Heat, would be very dangerous against the Heat because of the matchup. But they play the Boston Celtics in the playoffs, and that's where it stands right now. That's a 5-game series at best. Again, Celtics are not playing well right now. I'm giving the Celtics the benefit of the doubt. I don't think that the Celtics are all the way fully in tune to the regular season right now. I think they are waiting for the playoffs, and I don't think they care about getting the number one seed. I think if they finish second and third, that'll be fine with them. Remember, this is as bad as the Celtics are playing right now. This is no comparison to how they were playing going into the playoffs last season. Zero. I mean, they looked awful going into the playoffs last season. So I would not be too concerned if I were a Boston Celtics fan as far as where they might finish in the conference, as far as where they will finish in the conference. They will not finish no worse than third. And again, they have a 2-game lead on the Miami Heat in the loss column because they have already won the season series against Miami. Still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, I will tell you the real reason why the NFL moved up its kickoffs, and we will give a small preview to the Elite Eight of the NCAA tournament. That's still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. After the 12 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, Cyril Quinn taking the course to 12:30. NFL Competition Committee, of course, this week decided to move kickoffs up to the 35-yard line. Touchbacks will remain at the 20-yard line. This was, according to them, a preventive measure of head of concussions to lower the chances of guys getting concussions or any other head injuries. Listen, if you want to eliminate injuries on the particular concussions on kickoffs, then just eliminate kickoffs in general. That reasoning, it sounds good, and they're trying to play to the public. You know, you have a lot of concussion. A lot of issues with concussions going on in the world of sports in general, and even going on in the high school ranks. So they're trying to placate to the feelings of the public. I'm not fooled by any stretch of the imagination. The owners moved up kickoffs because that will, in essence, eliminate a lot of these specialists who are great on kickoffs and kickoffs only. So if you eliminate one half of that, let's say you have a guy who is decent on punt returns, great on kickoffs. Well, if you eliminate that part of the game or help hurt that part of the game, then you don't have to pay that guy, you know, major money. There are not too many guys in the NFL who are great at both kickoff and punt returns. Even Devin Hester, who is one of these guys who can be dominant on both, is not as good on kickoff returns. You have Daniel Manning on the Bears, who is the main kickoff guy. So, again, it's just a way for the owners to save some more money, put some more money in their own pockets. The NFL will set a record this year for touchbacks. They'll set records for touchbacks. So the more touchbacks you're getting on kickoffs, the more the less likely you have guys out there having big time years in terms of returning kickoffs. And I don't care how many punt returns you have for a touchdown or how many great punt returns, you're not going to get big money strictly being a big time punt returner. This is not going to happen. So again, with these owners, I'm always looking at. You always have to read between the lines in terms of why they're doing something, their logic behind what they're doing. not for the good of the sport. It has nothing to do about it. And it definitely does. And, I mean, think about this. If they care so much about player safety, then why are they trying to go to an 18-game season? Why are they trying to go to an 18-game season? Of course, added revenue. So it's always about the money when it comes down, when it's all said and done. Other NFL news in regards to NFL, Michael Vick had his jersey taken down back in 2007, his high school jersey taken down back in 2007 at Warwick High School. There's a student petition going around that want Vick's jersey put back up. The school officials refuse to do so because they feel like it will be a distraction going down the stretch of the school year. You know, if a football jersey is a distraction to your student body, then your school has issues on top of issues. If that's a distraction, then you have a major problem within your school. You know, hang the jersey back up. You know, you can use Michael Vick as an example of, you know, making a mistake and, you know, redeeming yourself. I mean, you can use that as a teaching point. If you're a school system, if you're a school in general, you know, it's Michael. How I'm just trying to figure out how is a jersey hanging up going to cause a distraction? Students all of a sudden going to start bringing guns to school because Michael Vick's jersey is hung up within the school? It doesn't make any sense to me. So, again, there's a petition going around Warwick High School in Newport News, Virginia, to have Michael Vick's jersey hung back up, put back up. We'll see what happens with it. It's a story that I will definitely keep up with over the duration of it. But just hang the jersey back up. I just don't get, people make Michael Vick out to be just, you know, Al Capone or somebody. I mean, geez. Yeah, like, it's, the situation is over and done with. He's paid his debt to society. He's going to continue to pay his debt to society as he receives, you know, the money, as he pays off his creditors and pays off all these debts that he has. So we'll see what happens with that going down the road. Still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, we will look ahead at the Elite Eight and who will be playing in the Final Four come next week. We'll be right back. Good morning, wake up call here, 24 minutes after the 12 o'clock hour, as we look ahead towards this weekend's Elite Eight. And, you know, you look at these eight teams, I can make a case for a good case for six of them having a legit chance to win a national championship. I don't think Butler or VCU can win a championship. Matter of fact, I don't think Florida either. I don't think Florida can win a championship. So I would say five. I would say Kentucky. I would say Kansas, Arizona, UConn, Kentucky, and North Carolina all can win a championship. Five out of the eight teams left can win a championship. Wouldn't be shocked. I would be shocked if VCU won a championship. Butler, Florida would be surprises. But it's anybody's ball game from here on out. Don't let anybody tell you that Kansas is clear. Is the team to beat? Do they have the most talent out of these remaining teams? Yes. But team to beat, I've been saying this since the tournament started. There is no team to beat at all. It's wide open, and you know we're going to see what happens here in these next couple of days. As far as the Final Four goes, today I like Arizona, and I like Butler to make it to the Final Four. I think Butler's experience, their defense will bother Florida. Florida has a size advantage, but I just like Butler's. I just like Butler's moxie. Butler is what now going on is 9-1 in the last 2 years in the NCAA tournament. They had one loss coming by 2 points to Duke in the national championship game last year. They just know how to make big plays at the right times. A lot of experience with Shelvin Mack, Ronald Norad, and of course Matt Howard. UConn Arizona would be a great game, but to me, Derrick Williams is the best player in the country. That I would give him the edge. As great as Kemba Walker has been, I give the edge. I think having Derrick Williams on your team is a matter of Arizona has Derrick Williams and UConn does not. I like Arizona in a close game. As far as tomorrow goes, I'll take North Carolina and Kansas. Kansas is going to kill VCU. That game will not be competitive as far as I'm concerned. VCU has had a great run, but I think that Cinderella will turn into a pumpkin and that their run will be over tomorrow when they take on the Jayhawks. And North Carolina, Kentucky will be a very close game, down, right down to the wire. You can toss out what happened in North Carolina this back in December. Both teams are completely different. These teams are much better than what they were in December, but I still like North Carolina to come to prevail in a very close game. Again, wouldn't be surprised either way. I think it's a 50-50 game, but I say North Carolina wins, 78-75, something to that extent. I believe it'll be a one possession game down the stretch, and I think that you will see a North Carolina, Arizona, Butler, Kansas Final Four. But again, would I be shocked? The only team that would be shocked that they won this week in terms of Elite Eight would be VCU. Kentucky certainly is more than capable of beating Florida, beating North Carolina. Certainly, Florida can beat Butler. UConn is more, the UConn Arizona is a toss up as well. Again, Derrick Williams to me is just that good. I mean, he's without question. If you're an NBA general manager, Derrick Williams if he chooses to come out, who knows? Well, have to see when the season's over with that decision. But if he chooses to come out, he is the number one pick in the draft. I mean, 6'8", 240. Put the ball on the floor, can shoot, can post up. I mean, the guy is a complete player right now as a sophomore. So you like him. I like Arizona in that particular game. Though UConn again, Kemba Walker has been dominant. And again, I'll be very interested to watch that Arizona UConn because to me, you cannot play Kemba Walker one on one. You can't play him one-on-one. You have to come up. You have to take the ball. Try to take the ball out of his hands. Make these other guys on UConn take shots. Beat you. Make a Lamb hit a million three-pointers. Make that big man make plays on the inside. You can't allow Kemba Walker to play one-on-one. To play one-on-one basketball. I don't understand what San Diego State was doing. There's not one guy in college basketball that could defend Kemba Walker one-on-one. It's just not going to happen. He's going to have a field day, which he certainly did against San Diego State. That's going to wrap up the program. Thanks for all the listeners. Chat room had Jay Drew, in the chat room. So I will open up the chat room. I will stay on for a couple of minutes in the chat room, even after the program is over. Have a great week. Enjoy the games, and I will see you this week, maybe on the Cyril Quinn Review come Monday or Tuesday. Stay tuned for that. So long.